questions. And the first thing I want to ask is, do you have any questions left over from yesterday? Any questions at all left over from yesterday? All right, the question I have for you, do you remember in the entire world, what is what's the most popular? Oh, that's how I'll ask it. What's the most popular religion in the world? What's that? Yeah, some form of Christianity. Exactly. In the United States, what's the most common religion? What's that? Christianity. Okay. In the entire world, what is the second most common religion in the world? Islam. That's right. Islam is second most common in the world. In the United States, what's the second most common religion? Yeah, unaffiliated. So the second most common religion in the United States is actually non-religion. And so the religiously unaffiliated, what kind of people does that include? Yeah, atheist, agnostic. Who else does it include? Yeah, so people who do not want to claim a religion. So in the United States, actually, about 67% of people who are religiously unaffiliated, 67% of them actually believe in some kind of God, some type of eternal force that's responsible for us and our existence. But they certainly don't claim to be a Christian, don't claim to be a Muslim, don't claim to be anything. And one of the other things that we noticed yesterday was that in the United States, that number, that percentage is growing pretty quickly. It's growing faster than the population itself, which means many people are converting out of religion or they're never being converted to religion. The people who are religiously unaffiliated, what are they normally like? What kind of demographics do they fit into? You remember? Yep, they're usually white, usually male. They're usually highly educated. What's the other thing? They're usually young. So that's why you all tend to come into contact with more people like that than someone like me would, because I guess I'm not that young anymore. I am still your youngest teacher this week, but I'm not that young anymore, and I'm not in school anymore. But you all, being young, being in school, going to the same educational places that they're going to, you run into more people like that. In the United States, it's most likely for you to run into someone who claims no religion at all. It's also very likely you'll run into people who claim no God at all. So we talked about atheism yesterday. We talked about some general religious views on God. So this is a slide I wanted to go back to. Ways that you can measure a religion. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to add to this if you wanted to or if you had questions. To me, this is really, really important. Wade was talking about some of the philosophical arguments for a defense of Christianity, in particular the existence of evil, the moral argument there. John's been talking about, you know, how do you measure a religious text or an ancient text at all? And I agree with his point that you should measure the Bible in the same way that you measure other manuscripts. And I feel like it's completely appropriate to measure all religions in the same way as well. Remember, I told you yesterday that was kind of my goal going into my original study on religion back in 2013, and I didn't know what I would find. But these are the ways that we're measuring a religion. Does it agree with logic? For the most part, does it agree with science? Does it agree with history? What is its origin? Who is its founder? What is its holy text? And how does it prove itself? Yesterday we talked about Hinduism, and we were in the middle of discussing several of its major beliefs. A disclaimer I mentioned yesterday is I can't guarantee you that every Hindu would agree with everything I'm saying here, but I think these are good generalizations. One of the big things about Hinduism is the belief in many gods. They do believe in a single impersonal oneness or this spiritual force that's responsible for this universe, but it's not a force that you could speak to or that speaks back to you. And that eternal oneness is responsible for all the manifestations of God that they see in the world. Thousands of them. One of the things we mentioned yesterday is that the Hindu gods have evolved over time, which to me is sort of a knock against Hinduism. In Christianity, God has always been the creator. In Hinduism, it's not always been like that. First, it was Varuna, then it was Indra, then it was Brahma. And so that evolution of the creator God bothers me some. The next thing that we're going to talk about that we haven't said much about yet is divine tradition. To me, this is very interesting about Hindu. Part of the reason for the obvious differences in belief in Hinduism is because Hindus are not actually that concerned with beliefs. I can't guarantee you that every Hindu would say that, but in general, Hindus are not actually that concerned with belief at all. In Hinduism, there's actually a serious and more emphasis on religious rituals as opposed to beliefs or doctrines. Do you see how that's somewhat different than Christianity? Do you feel like what you believe is very important as a Christian? Do you feel like what you believe is really important, foundational to who you are as a Christian? I mean, that's how I feel. Belief is important. In Christianity, faith, that belief in God is kind of the key that opens the door of God's grace. That faith is very important to God. Beliefs matter in Christianity a lot. Hinduism doesn't matter as much. There's a serious emphasis on divine traditions. So things like meditation, very important in Hinduism. Recitation of divine sayings in Hinduism, very, very important. By the way, in Hinduism, it doesn't actually matter if you understand what you're saying. We'll talk about that a little bit more later as well. Yoga is a practice of Hinduism. So yoga actually started in Hindu. Did you know that when you girls are doing your thing, your yoga stuff, whatever that is, downward facing dog, I'm a tree, I'm a bird. I don't know what they are, but that stuff. So all of that started in Hinduism. And yoga as it exists now, I don't think most of you are approaching it as a spiritual experience. Hindus do. To me, that's interesting to know. I don't know when yoga really got popular in the United States. I guess probably back in the 60s or so. I probably would have objected to yoga in the 1960s because it was drawing from a false religion. And they believed that those motions, those postures were divine, a connection to the divine. So now, probably not such a big deal, but a few decades ago, I probably would have objected to it because it was a tradition borrowed from a false religion, what I believe to be a false religion. And by the way, interrupt me at any point if you have questions. So Scripture, although I've just told you that tradition is important to Hindus, Scripture is also important to Hindus. Hindus believe in the truthfulness of their holy scripture, which is mostly the Vedas or Vedas, however you want to pronounce it. There's four of them. So we have one Bible, but two testaments. They have one set of scripture and is primarily based in what's called the Vedas, the holy Vedas. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. So what's interesting, though, about how they regard scripture, they regard scripture as being from their gods, manifestations of holiness. But that doesn't mean, in a Hindu's mind, that they have to take the Vedas as literally true or practice everything that is taught in them. So that's something that Hindus will agree on. So they believe that the Hindu scripture is true and good, but they don't feel like they have to believe that it's literally true or they have to literally do the things that are in the Vedas. And part of that is because there's some very carnal things in the Vedas. And, I mean, so carnal that I don't even think it would be appropriate to talk about it in this setting. So if that tells you the kind of things that you might read about. And you, as a matter of fact, you've got the same issue when you read the Quran and some of the other sayings of Muhammad. Things so carnal, so sensual that I would feel uncomfortable talking about it in front of you. So we'll talk about this later. I keep saying that. But whenever I see something like that, to me that immediately doesn't pass the logic test. When something is at face value, apparently very carnal, sensual, emphasizing the sexuality of the human nature, that immediately doesn't seem to pass the logic test with me. Something else that's unique about Hinduism is a cylindrical view of time. I didn't put this on the board. Cylindrical view of time. So somebody that's familiar with Hinduism, tell me what you think that means. Or excuse me, a cyclical view of time. What do you think that means in Hinduism? Yeah, it does. It's related to that. So not only do they believe that people are reincarnated, they believe that this whole universe goes through endless cycles of creation, cessation, and then dissolution. So I think that's interesting. So they think the world over eons of time is constantly being created It's being maintained, and then it's being dissolved just to be created again. Have you ever heard the term karma? So, as a Christian, I would recommend you don't use the word karma, because karma has a specific meaning. It comes from Hinduism. And when people use the word karma, what do they usually mean by that? Somebody just give me an example of what karma means when people use that. Go ahead. Yeah, yeah, you'll get what you give. What goes around comes around. Yeah, as you sow, you will reap. So that the idea is actually also existing in Christianity. But that term karma means something specific in Hinduism. The law of karma is essentially the moral equivalent of the natural law of cause and effect. So Hinduism says if you're an evil person, the spiritual forces of this world, so not just accidentally, the spiritual forces of this world will cause bad things to happen to you. So karma is a Hindu belief that the spiritual forces make bad things happen to you. I know lots of people who believe in karma in the same way that they, you know, believe that they exist. They think karma is real, and I don't think they have any idea that that's a religious belief that comes from Hinduism. So, I mean, that's completely a judgment thing. My recommendation is that you don't use the word karma. You say something biblical, like you reap what you sow or something like that. But karma in Hinduism is a reference to this invisible spiritual force that makes sure that you get what you give. Another big idea in Hinduism is an idea called samsara. And so in light of karma, because of this moral cause and effect, Hindus believe that humans are in what I call that term samsara, which basically means suffering. Humans are in suffering because of their own evil. And this suffering is caused by people needing to work off bad karma. So that's what Hindus believe. If you are suffering, a Hindu believes that you brought that upon yourself, but not because of sin or evil in this life now, but because of sin or evil in previous lives. So that's really interesting to me in Hinduism. One more thing about Hinduism is ahimsa. Ahimsa is nonviolence to life. Hindus have a great respect for life, all life. And this is a noble thing. They want to cause the least amount of harm possible. This applies to humans, but it also applies to animals as well. When I was researching Hinduism, what have you heard about Hindus and their regard for animals? Go ahead, Sarah. Oh, okay. Yeah, so that is correct. That is correct. So they treat an animal as if that animal actually has a soul that eventually will become a person, and if they treat that animal badly, that in their next life, they might be an abused animal. Go ahead, John. Yeah. Yeah, so some Hindus are extremely serious about this. I have heard people say, and I've never actually read this, maybe it's out there and I've just never noticed it, but I've heard people say that some Hindus, like, don't eat beef because they have a high regard for cows. I've never read that, but I know it's true because my wife met a Hindu at a barbecue and he wouldn't eat the hamburgers. So not a joke, it actually happened. So that's confirmation that at least some Hindus believe in that way. A very serious regard for life. Another thing that Hindus believe is that there is no one true religion. They think that Hinduism is the best religion, but they don't dismiss the importance of other religions. And this is actually why Hinduism is attractive to some people. Because Hindus think that, yeah, Hinduism is the best religion, but all of these other religions are also products of the gods. They would say that Christianity was sort of given to the Western world because that's what we could take, because that's what we would believe. That's what a Hindu would say, that we wouldn't take Hinduism, so the gods gave us Christianity instead. That people further east, they couldn't take Hinduism, so the gods gave them Buddhism. You see how that works? And that's why some people like this Eastern philosophy. So those are some of the major beliefs of Hinduism. Anything you want to ask or say about that? I can't promise to give you the answer. Go ahead. Yeah. So part of the reason for that, and this is not something I believe at all. But Hindus think that the same kind of soul that's in a human being is also in an animal. That same piece of the divine nature that makes them alive is the exact same thing that's making, you know, other creatures alive. So that's why they have such a serious regard for animals, because they think God, the gods are in everything, and that they, if they don't treat animals well in their next life, they might be an animal. So that's kind of where the reincarnation comes into. I don't know if I said this clearly, but Hindus believe that it's important to be good in this life so that when you're reborn again, you'll be born into a better life. And eventually you can become a god and things like that. While the caste system existed in India, so that was like sort of a social order. There was like slaves at the very bottom, the very wealthy, and political leaders at the very top. So that was part of it as well. So if you were a slave, you wanted to be good so that in your next life you could be born into a higher level of that caste system in India. So let's talk about the holy text. We'll get through this quickly. I've already mentioned how their holy texts are called the Vedas. They contain many books. There are four books. They contain a lot of psalms, recitations to the gods. They are considered a binding law for the Hindus. But like I've said already, and this is so important about Hinduism, their concern is not so much with the message or the meaning. Let me read to you something that a Hindu writer said. This is what they say about the Vedas. The words of the Vedas are intrinsically powerful. Every syllable is sacred, and the repetition of the scripture is auspicious in and of itself. So even if you have no idea what it means, just saying the words, they say, is of a benefit to your soul. It is sacred sound, not a sacred book, which is venerated. The books of the Vedas are cherished not only for their great wisdom and moral instruction, but for the holy sounds contained within. Understanding the text is unnecessary. Scripture's value lies in its oral repetition. The Vedas sanctity often appears to be inversely related to the comprehensibility. Let me read that part again. The scripture's sanctity often seems to be inversely related to its comprehensibility. So basically what that Hindu is saying is if you don't understand what it's saying, then it's really holy. And they think that is of a benefit to your soul. And so that's why Hindus really don't care about what the Vedas say. And if you were to pick up a Veda, and if you want to do it, go for it, it's not going to make any sense. And that's not an insult on someone who's a Hindu. It's not an insult to the people who ascribe to that religion. But it's not going to make sense. And a Hindu doesn't care if it makes sense. And that's why, like I said last night, there's innumerable contradictions in the Vedas. And they don't care. Because it's as much in the sounds and the syllables and the recitation. That's what they care about. Not so much the meaning. So about the origin of the Vedas, they are extremely old. Older than the law of Moses. And that's one reason, I was talking to Flynn about this, that's one reason that people offer Hinduism as, you know, the religion, because it's a very, very old religion. And the Vedas are very, very old. But here's the thing that's interesting. The Vedas originated long after Hinduism itself. So I told you Hinduism started in about 2000 BC. The Vedas didn't show up in written form until at least 500 years later. And then, you know, manuscript copies of the Vedas hundreds and hundreds of more years later. So another test that shows you that the authenticity of the Bible is greatly superior to lots of manuscripts, lots of things from ancient periods, including other holy texts like this. That's really all I want to say about the holy texts of Hinduism. Anything you want to add to it? Questions or comments? Any of you know Vic Reddy? A few of you. He is an unbelievable man. I really hadn't spent any time with him until 3 years ago. I went to Chicago for something and spent some time with his family. Incredibly genuine, loving person. Just overwhelmed with the love that they had to show me. If you go to Chicago, find Vic Reddy, and you just won't want to leave. He and Sue are very, very good people. So Vic was born and raised in India. He's now a member of the church. that meets in the Chicago area. He was not raised a Hindu, but he was raised around lots of Hindus. So I sent him a message just asking him if there's anything in particular that he would want me to share with a group like this about Hinduism. And I actually didn't know that he wasn't raised Hindu. I had no idea what his background was. So he was born a Hindu. I don't know exactly what he meant by that, but he was born a Hindu. Maybe that meant he was born into a Hindu family. But he was raised in Catholic schools. He didn't have that much awareness of Hinduism, but he certainly was around it a lot. So a few specific things that he told me about Hinduism that you'll find interesting. And these are his words, not mine. Here's what Vic says. Hinduism has thousands of gods, and it is not unusual that in a single family unit, the father might worship one god, the mother might worship another god, and the children another god. Each of these thousands of gods have their own identity and their own strengths. As an example, there is a specific god for fertility, another for excelling in education, another for good health, yet another for wealth, and so on. His next point. Each god, whether male or female, have their own images in the form of idols and temples where people go to worship. He says, I was quite familiar with going to the temple of the god of education, especially before exams, and offering flowers and fruits with the hope that I would do well in my studies. So he wasn't even a Hindu, but that was the culture that he was in. People would go to the temple of the god of education. That's who that is. She's also the goddess of music and arts and stuff like that. Anyway, so he would go to that god's temple and put fruit and flowers out. Of course, that was obviously before he became a Christian. Another thing he says about Hinduism. Hinduism's core principle is plurality, meaning it believes the existence of multiple legitimate religions and spiritual paths exist that lead to the soul salvation or the attainment of nirvana. He says, it is my belief that the reason for the relative lack of racial tension in India is made up, which is made up of millions of Muslim, Christians, and Buddhists, is based on Hindus' acceptance of this plurality. One more thing he says that I found very interesting. Hindus believe that divinity exists in all living things. The Hindu greeting, namaste, I have no idea if I'm saying that right. The Hindu greeting, did somebody know how to say it? Namaste. Okay, thanks. I'm glad to know. Namaste. Okay, do you know what it means? Okay, so Vic told me what it literally means. So apparently that's how Hindus use it, to say hello and goodbye. But apparently what it literally means is the divine in me bows to the divine in you. I thought that was interesting. So I'd ask for questions, but this is all from Vic. So ask Vic, be his friend on Facebook. So what about the Christian response? This is pretty important. And not to demean Hinduism, again, I told you yesterday that my goal is to be honest and objective, not to be derogatory, but to be clear. You know, our goal is to be right. And there's some obvious observations to make in Hinduism. So even though Hinduism sees Christianity as an acceptable but inferior religion, our view as Christians has to be that Hinduism is a false religion. We said yesterday, John 14:6, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, the light. No one comes to the Father except through me. Christianity, Jesus himself is completely exclusive of all other pathways to God. But Hinduism says, actually, that's not really true. So even though Hinduism accepts Christianity, a Christian can't accept Hinduism. And there's some other good reasons to do that. One is the logical failures of Hinduism in my mind. For example, the Vedas, technically speaking, are only supposed to be read in Sanskrit, which is an ancient language of India. Did we ever have a situation like that in Christianity? Sure we did. For a long time, the Bible was locked up in the Latin language, and so the common people couldn't read it, and the common people weren't supposed to read it. And that was wrong. And so when you see that institutionalized in another religion, to me, that doesn't pass the logical test, that a religion is locked up in a language that most people can't access. Another thing that doesn't pass the logic test, things like rape are actually allowed for in the Vedas. I don't think a Hindu today would tell you that's okay, but the Vedas tell you that's okay. Bestiality is allowed and encouraged in some circumstances in the Vedas. I don't even know if I want to say this or not, but if you were to go to India and go to the temples of these gods, the things that I'm telling you would be very obvious. The sensuality is all over the temples. The rape, the incest, the bestiality, it's right there. And once again, to me, that doesn't pass the logic test. That can't be the only reason to dismiss a religion, but to me, that doesn't pass the logic test. So other reasons, and this is really the biggest one in my mind. We've been spending a lot of time this week talking about reasons to be a Christian. Hinduism offers no reasons to be a Hindu. Hinduism offers no reasons to be a Hindu. Their arguments for being Hindu, well, number one, they really don't offer a lot, but the ones that they do offer are extremely weak. You know, one is that it seems to be the oldest religion. Something being old doesn't inherently make it right. The Mosaic Law is older than Christianity, but does that make the Mosaic Law true today? No. Okay, so you apply the same test to Hinduism. Just because it's old doesn't make it right. In general, the defense of Hinduism is based on philosophy and not observation. So if you look up a defense of Hinduism, looking for apologetics on Hinduism, number one, you're going to find almost nothing. You're going to find almost nothing. What you do find will largely be philosophical. What a Hindu will tell you is, this is right because it makes sense. This is right because it makes sense. Well, that's not a good enough reason for me. And the other apologetics that you do find, like I've said, are extremely weak. So I found very few resources that offered a defense of Hinduism. And one that I found, I feel like I'm building a straw man for you here, but it was incredibly weak. So here's one of the things that this man said in defense of Hinduism. It was a huge, huge document, but here's one thing he says. My son has a spiral on his back because I was reciting a mantra at the time of his conception. So his son has some kind of spiral on his back, and he believes that that happened because he was reciting some phrase from Hinduism during the conception process, and he thinks that that's evidence that Hinduism is true. There's a book about reincarnation, and this person's talking about that book, and here's what he says. He says, the books show people with birthmarks, birth defects, and other anomalies due to something that happened in a past life. Some examples they give. A man with a mark of a rope around his neck remembers that he was hanged to death in his immediate past life. There is another man who has multiple birthmarks on his abdomen, and he remembers that he was stabbed to death in his immediate past life. So, you know, not to mock those kind of things, but like that's what they offer as evidence of Hinduism. That's what they have to offer. What do we have to offer in Christianity as evidence of the Christian religion? And I really want your thoughts on this. What kind of things does Christianity offer as evidence? Yeah, so that's like the giant one. Fulfilled prophecy, right? The God of the Bible tells the end from the beginning. And we're going to talk about this a lot tomorrow because I don't know what you all know, but I want to make sure that you really appreciate how powerful and strong the defense of Christianity is compared to the defense that you see in other religions. In another religion, they're literally telling you that a birthmark on someone's stomach is evidence of the validity of that religion. That's not convincing to me. But when I read in the Bible and I see that the prophets said that the Messiah would be called a Nazarene, that he would come from Bethlehem, that he would be rejected by his own people, that his hands and his feet would be pierced, that he would come 490-ish years later after the declaration to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. When Daniel says that there's going to be a succession of four world powers, that's convincing to me. That's convincing to me to see God say those things. A birthmark on someone's stomach is not convincing to me. The last thing that this person said in his defense of Hinduism was what kind of sealed the deal in my mind. He said, it must be experienced to believe, to be believed. It must be experienced to be believed. So that's like someone telling you, trust me, you are going to love this car. Just buy it, drive it, and I guarantee you, you will love it. Right? So if you wouldn't do that with a new car, would you do that with your soul? I wouldn't. So that is Hinduism. That is everything I wanted to say about Hinduism. Do you have anything else you want to say about Hinduism? Any point that you want to add to that? I'm sure there's plenty of you that know as much about this as I do. Sarah? Well, they believe in thousands of gods, but they think all of those gods initially came from this impersonal spiritual force. Yeah. I know that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, which is part of the reason I'm not a Hindu. But does that make sense, my answer anyway? Anything else? What religion do you want to talk about next? Please pick Buddhism. That's exactly what I was thinking. Let's go to Buddhism. You guys are great. All right, so let's talk about Buddhism. The reason I'm talking about Buddhism next is because Buddhism came from Hinduism. There's lots of religions that grew out of Hinduism. Buddhism is one of them. So the person who eventually became known as Buddha, Buddha was a real person, so he's not a made-up person. Things about him are made up, but he was a real person. You could have met Buddha. Many people did meet the Buddha. But the person that came to be known as Buddha was born in the present-day country of Nepal near India. And like pretty much everyone of India, Buddha was originally born a Hindu. And he eventually became dissatisfied with Hinduism. He started looking for some other explanations of life. The reason he was dissatisfied with his religion is he could see that, like all of us, all of our physical successes in life eventually will go away because of death. And suffering is a part of life, an inherent part of life. And so after years of wandering and self-deprivation, he became enlightened, which is why he's called the Buddha. And by enlightened, what he means and what Buddhists mean is that he had a realization about his own nature. He believes that he could see that his own thinking was the obstacle that was preventing him from understanding the spiritual truths that he was seeking. And so he felt like once he controlled his own thinking, once he removed that obstacle, that he would come to understand that his sense of individuality and being a soul was an illusion. Chew on that one for a second. What Buddha believed is that by controlling your thinking, by eliminating a sense of suffering in your life, you would come to understand that your sense of self and self-awareness is just an illusion. And he felt like that was the only way to escape suffering. So in Christianity, we escape suffering by being obedient to God and getting to be in heaven with God, by believing in Jesus, by being faithful to Jesus. In Buddhism, their belief is that to escape suffering, you have to escape yourself. And so he believes that he did this. He became enlightened. So he lived in the 5th century BC, and the religion that became Buddhism was formed shortly after that. So what are some of the major things that Buddhists believe? One is the Four Noble Truths. I'll go through these quickly so we can really get to the Christian response to Buddhism. But the Four Noble Truths. So these are the basic principles of Buddhism. Number one, and most of these, some of these things are true. We'll talk about that in a little bit as well. But some of these things are true. So one truth is human life is full of suffering. He considered that his first noble truth. Second noble truth in Buddhism, suffering stems from cravings for pleasure and avoidance of pain. Noble truth number three, suffering can be eradicated. Noble truth number four, the path of freedom from suffering is the path of enlightenment. Buddhists are also very serious about certain ethical guidelines. So the Buddhist religion includes a number of ethical guidelines, such as you don't take human life, you don't lie, you don't steal, you don't use intoxicants, you don't engage in illicit sexual behavior. So are all of those things like good things in life? Yeah, I mean, all of those things are true. And so one of the temptations that people have is they look at a religion like Buddhism and they see things that are obviously true. And so they think, well, the religion must be true. They think, well, that means Buddhism is not that much different from Christianity. How different is Buddhism from Christianity, though? What was one of some of the things we talked about yesterday? What is a Buddhist view of God? That there is none. Or, at best, that it doesn't matter if there's a God. So that's to me why I couldn't be comfortable embracing Buddhism as a legitimate religion, because at the very beginning they reject the existence of God or the need for there to be a God in order for them to live righteously. So Buddhists also believe in the idea of reincarnation, that once you die, you're born again as someone or something in that process of reincarnation. So Buddhists believe that you could be born as another person, but they also believe that you could be born as a rat, a snake, you could be born as a ghost, you could be born as a dog, a cow, or anything. And I mentioned this yesterday, but one of the reasons that I have a real problem accepting the logic test in Buddhism is, in Buddhism, what's the reward for living a sufficiently good life, for attaining enlightenment? What's the reward in Buddhism? You cease to exist. And again, I'm not, you know, being derogatory towards Buddhism, but does that make you want to be a Buddhist? Do you want to cease to exist? So I read more about this last night just to make sure I was right in what I'm saying. And as far as I can tell, I'm right in what I'm saying. That in nirvana, which is what you're looking for as a Buddhist, you no longer are aware of yourself. That's how you are free from suffering. That you continue to be reincarnated until you get to a point that you're not even aware of yourself. You cease to exist in that sense. And in Buddhism, apparently that's a good thing. That's what you want. So, and that's kind of the last thing I was talking about there on the slide there, that self-illusion is another big point in Buddhism. The Buddha taught that self-awareness, or the soul, your individuality, is an illusion. And you will continue to engage in that illusion until you break free from suffering and achieve nirvana. So a few things about the holy texts of Buddhism. Some interesting, some not so interesting. Buddha taught for about 45 years over a very, very large region. And even though he taught so much for so long, at the time of his death, how many words of the Buddha do you think were written down? None. How many think were written down 100 years later? Still none. 200, 300. About 400 years later is the first time that any Buddhist put pen to paper to write down the words of the Buddha. This, to me, is one of the failures of Buddhism. So for 400 years, the only way that the words of Buddha were maintained was through oral tradition. It was just through oral tradition. And you know how that goes. You guys have all played the telephone game, right? So I gave you the example of the telephone game at camp, if you guys remember it. So I'm kind of famous, or maybe this is Excelsior Springs. But either way, you should know I'm kind of famous. I got my picture in Field and Stream. Raise your hand if you know what the magazine Field and Stream is. Did you see me in Field and Stream? Wow. So Field and Stream is like this really awesome magazine that really awesome people get into. And I was in it, so you kind of see the logic there. Anyway, I posted some pictures of these really two giant fish that I caught on the Field and Stream website. And they contacted me, and they said, hey, we'll send you this knife set if you let us use your picture in Field and Stream. So I said, yeah. My picture was in Field and Stream. I never got the knife set, so that was kind of lame. But the point is, though, one of my aunts, I don't know how she heard about this, but one of my aunts started telling people that my nephew is going to be on the cover of Field and Stream. So no one ever saw that, and no one ever saw my picture because it was like this big. It was this tiny, tiny little picture. And anyway, that's why I'm not a huge fan of oral transmission of knowledge, because that was my big moment, and it all was ruined. Imagine how awesome I would have been if that had gone on for 400 years. So in Buddhism, what I'm saying is, can you trust something that's only been transmitted through oral tradition for 400 years before it was ever written down? I can't trust in that. Some things about what you'll find if you read the Buddhist text. Most of the writings are divided into three baskets, is what they're called. I don't know. If you're using the language that we use, you know, we've got an Old and a New Testament. They've got three baskets. The first basket has, it's not literal baskets, it's just organization. But the first basket has Buddha's discourses, stories, anecdotes, various comments about his understanding of the path to enlightenment. The second basket has guidelines for monks. The third basket is something that came much later but contains some similar things. Something that's important to know about the writings of Buddhism is there's no consensus at all. One of the things I like about Christianity is, with the exception of Catholicism and the Greek Orthodox Church and a few other denominations of Christianity, for the most part, though, we know what our books are. The overwhelming majority, well, most Christians are in agreement on what the books of Christianity are. It's not so with Buddhism. There's not a uniform collection. There's different varieties of Buddhists that use different books. And again, that's bothersome to me. So what about the actual Christian response? The Christian response to Buddhism. So there's at least three things that, you know, in the event that you ever came in contact with someone who's Buddhist, these are three things to me that failed the defense of Buddhism. One, like we've mentioned already, is in Buddhism there's no God, and at best there's no need for God. Buddha denied or ignored the existence of God, which to me immediately makes any religion in disagreement with science and logic. I think if we went around the room, most of you would probably say that when you look at this creation, God is calling to you from this creation, that you can look at that and you see Him there. And a Buddhist, though, looks at that and doesn't see God and says there is no God. That bothers me. That's, in my mind, part of the Christian response. Another thing, too, that I have a problem with in Buddhism is, besides having no God, they offer no proof. So one of the problems with Hinduism is they really don't offer any apologetics. They don't give me any reason in Hinduism to believe that their religion is right. Same problem with Buddhism. There's no serious offering of substantiation for that religion. No proof that Buddhist teachings are right. Buddha himself said that he was just a man, that he was an enlightened man, but he was just a man. And so he's telling you, Buddha himself is telling you, I'm just a man, and these are the spiritual truths that you need to know. Well, how did he know them? How do we know that he's right? How do we know that he's right? Buddhism offers no serious explanation for how Buddhism is correct. If he was just a man, why should he be believed? What's the evidence that the words of Buddha and the Buddhist texts are true? And another thing, too, about the Buddhist text, how reliable can a text be if it's written down 400 years after the original words were spoken? Any comments or questions? One more thing. To me, this is the most interesting thing about Buddhism. And I don't know if this will take 5 minutes or not. What do you think a Buddhist says about Jesus? Just take a stab at it. I didn't know this until I was studying, actually, for today. What do you think a Buddhist would say about Jesus? Any guesses? Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure in a lot of cases a Buddhist would say nothing about Jesus. So does anyone know who the Dalai Lama is? Somebody tell me, who is the Dalai Lama? He's a Buddhist. Gave you that one. Several of you shook your head. Now you're not saying anything. All right, so I will tell you about the Dalai Lama. So the Dalai Lama is a Buddhist. He is the leader of Buddhism in Tibet. And that's just one branch of Buddhism. Really, really interesting. If I understand it correctly, this is just as an aside. So the Dalai Lama is the Dalai Lama from basically his boyhood all the way until his death. Has anyone ever read about how they identify the next Dalai Lama? So, not to be derogatory at all, it's just kind of interesting. In a religion that doesn't believe in God, that doesn't believe in the supernatural. So, when the current Dalai Lama dies, there's all these Buddhist monks. They've got to find the next Dalai Lama, the next leader of Buddhism. And they believe that the Dalai Lama has already been appointed by, you know, some invisible spiritual force. And they look for clues as to where to go looking for the next Dalai Lama. And so one of the things they'll do is, you've got the dead Dalai Lama right here, and when they go home and come back the next day, they'll check to see if his head has, like, turned one way or the other. And so if his nose is pointing this direction, then the next Dalai Lama is over there somewhere. And so
That's where they go.
And they go look for the next Dalai Lama. It's interesting, in a world that doesn't believe in God, they still believe in these supernatural forces. So anyway, Dalai Lama, a few years ago, was interviewed about Jesus. And there's an argument that exists between Buddhists and Jesus. And Christians always win because there's no answer in Buddhism. But here's what the Dalai Lama said. So the obvious dilemma, let me tell you this first. Buddhists believe that Jesus was an enlightened one like Buddha. So you can already see where the problem is going to go. Buddhists believe that Jesus was an enlightened one like Buddha. So what would you say? If you knew that, what would you say to someone who was Buddhist? I know you would say something, so say something. Yeah, I mean, that's it, right? So if Jesus was an enlightened one, why does he say something that's obviously completely different from what the Buddha originally said? That's the obvious problem here. And so here's the response from the Dalai Lama. Jesus Christ also lived previous lives. So, you see, he reached a high state through Buddhist practice or something like that. Then at a certain period, certain era, he, still talking about Jesus, appeared as a new master. And then because of the circumstances, he taught certain views different from Buddhism, but he also taught some of the same religious values in Buddhism. Be patient, tolerant, compassionate. This, you see, is the real message in order to become a better human being. That's the defense of Buddhism. So Buddhism, on one hand, says that Jesus was an enlightened one, but then there's really no serious explanation for how is it that Jesus, being enlightened, obviously taught things that were exclusive of Buddhism. So if you're going to take something away from this discussion on Buddhism, that's what you would want to say if you were talking to someone who is a Buddhist. Ask them about Jesus, and that's probably where the conversation will go. Ask them how they prove and substantiate Buddhism. I've got 2 minutes left. I think we'll not start Islam so that we can start it tomorrow. Any questions or comments? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the objective in Buddhism, is to escape your own thinking, to escape your own sense of self until you cease to exist completely. So thanks for your time and attention. We'll go ahead and stop 2 minutes early.
Professor basically calls him.